The Lonely Arts Club is a series of interviews with creative and cultural people discovering their journey into the arts and where it's led them. As we launch series two of The Lonely Arts Club, the UK is under lockdown, meaning the quality of some of our episodes may be slightly different to normal. This week, Martin McQuillan is joined by Beedi Finzi. Beedi is a filmmaker and one of the founders of the Doc Society, formerly known as BritDoc. We hear Beedi's story that begins running amok on a Portuguese farm to the miracles of making it through college and into Oxford. Beedi shares with us her passion for filmmaking and where her dream of the Doc Society all began.
Beedi, welcome to the Lonely Arts Club.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to see you. And I'm sorry we're not in person with a great cup of coffee together.
But we are Zooming. Where are you this morning?
I'm in sunny West London. I'm here in a flat with my partner, two kids, close by to some elders who need frequent food supplies, but we're keeping in good spirits. And it's been really, really, really busy, actually. I know everyone's kind of micro-universes are very different, but it's been relentless, actually. It's been relentless. And not unsurprisingly, many, many, many filmmakers, first of all, just thinking about the immediate community of filmmakers who wanting and needing advice, ideas, brainstorming, troubleshooting each of their slightly different situations. And then, of course, there's the kind of constellation of partner organizations, both here in the UK and abroad, who are doing the same process of adaptation and adjustment and emergency planning, but also future strategizing. So, yeah, that kind of bouncing between kind of immediate crises and troubleshooting and trying to make space for those bigger conversations about what comes now in the next couple of years, because it's an extraordinary moment for all of us and for culture and arts and independent storytelling, no less a momentous moment. And how we meet that, those challenges, but also maybe try to think about how to design a better future is, I think, the order of the day.
How easy has it been to do over teleconferencing and just using phones?
Well, there's a funny way in which actually we've all been able to get together much more easily and much more equitably. You know, I had an extraordinary experience last week. I was co-hosting a lab. I was meant to be in Mexico City. I wasn't in Mexico City. I was sitting here in West London. And, you know, there were 25 extraordinary Mexican filmmakers. We also had two simultaneous translators and then a third translator who was, we had an audio impaired participant. So we had a translator dedicated to translating her Mexican into my English. I mean, it was actually the most extraordinary meeting. And in some ways, I thought to myself, this virtual technology allows a kind of additional piece of care around accessibility, which actually I really appreciate. I mean, that was just one lab, you know, with one group of filmmakers. But, it, you know, in the average week, I might be having a sector meeting in the UK, a kind of like international meeting. And we're coming together rapidly, effectively, cheaply, in ways that we couldn't before. So I don't know. The glass half full piece of this is that we're all talking a hell of a lot more. And I really am enjoying that. I welcome that. And I hope some of that sticks post-COVID.
Now, it's lovely to be able to do this podcast with you, because usually we record in a studio in Liverpool, and it would involve people coming up to Liverpool or whoever was passing through Liverpool that week. We wouldn't normally get to catch you unless you were passing through the city. So this is great fun. We can talk a little bit about what Doc Society is up to in a moment, but on the Lonely Arts Club, we like to go back to the beginning and take a deep dive into how it all happened. So if we go back to the beginning, where did you grow up?
I had nomadic parents who were separated and both nomadic. So go figure, that's ultra nomadic childhood. So home was a lot of different places, different bits of Europe. My dad ended up in the Middle East. But actually, in terms of both my parents' families, which is funny enough where I think I come from, you know, my mum's family are from Essex. and my dad's family in Hampshire. And so both of those places, both of those landscapes, I feel profoundly emotional, nostalgic for and about.
So who were your parents?
My father was a musician, and my mother, I don't know how I'd even do it, you know, she was busy being a fantastic hustler, now I look back on it, trying to bring us up and hustling here and there, doing a bit of translation, doing a bit of boxing and coxing, bits of freelance work to make ends meet. She didn't have a conventional career per se, and neither did my dad. He gave up a career in classical music. They threw in that life because it was just very hard. And they bought a farm in southern Portugal in the early 70s and decided they were going to be farmers. And that was a disaster. And their marriage was up quite quickly after the farm was. So he disappeared to the Middle East. And then my mum just kind of hustles for the next 30, 40 years. So, yeah, I describe it as a childhood and, you know, young adulthood, you know, that was forged by two people who were actually in their own ways kind of entrepreneurial. They were, you know, not particularly of means. So learning to hustle and get by and be adaptive was second nature. My dad, fiercely musical. My mum, quite fiercely intellectual in some ways, though, you know, she had a brief period as an academic in her early life. But those were the kind of forces that forged.
So did you grow up on the farm in Portugal? Did you spend any time there? Or was that?
And my first 8 years. And it was a fantastic time. You know, there was I ran feral a lot. And the revolution was happening. And so it was a moment of kind of social upheaval in Portugal, the Carnation Revolution, as it was called. And so, yeah, it was a little bit like Hideous Kinky, but set in southern Portugal. That's what it felt like. It was a very wild time. And, you know, my mum searching for herself and her identity and her life. And I just ran about on beaches and ran through these small towns. There was no tourism there. It was a very kind of remote, rural, very simple country life. And, you know, everyone looked out for the little English kid running amok.
How's your Portuguese?
Well, it's bizarre. I was bilingual as a young'un, completely bilingual. You know, I wasn't taught or trained. I just picked it up. And I had thought it was all gone. And then I started traveling to Brazil a few years ago for work. And it was this bizarre kind of piece of my lizard brain I could feel activating. I would hear phrases and sounds, even tastes. And it was kind of triggering some kind of piece of corpuscle that had long been ossified. So I think it's actually all, I could probably get it all going if I paid it some attention.
Well, I'll remember that. Next time I need some Portuguese translated, I know where to come. So where did you go to school, if at all?
That's a good question. There wasn't much school to begin with. And then my mum got really broke. The Portuguese adventures lasted for a bit and then she was really broke. So she came home to her mother's house in Essex. That wasn't probably a great period for her, but again, my gran lived just outside Witham. People who know from that part of the country, it's just more flat farming country, and I again carried on running around. I went to a little school in Colchester, and then someone had the bright idea that I should be dispatched because I was a little bit wild, that I should be sent to be improved. And some of my cousins had been sent to this boarding school in Dorset, and I was dispatched there. And I, you know, to call it a period of abject misery just doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. I hated it so much. I mean, I was a bit too wild and untaught, and I wasn't versed in English education, and I couldn't have been a more of a fish out of water. And it was a terrible, terrible, terrible time. And it probably made sense for the family because they all needed to try and find work and crack on. And here was this kid, and it was just probably easier if I was sent away. But my God, it made me fiercely... Yeah, I mean, when I had my own kids, not even if I could have afforded it, but not in a million years would I ever send them away. It was totally scarring as an experience.
How old were you at this point?
I think I must have gone when I was about 10 or 11, something like that. Young. I mean, it felt young to me. I know some people have sent their kids off earlier, but yeah, it felt criminal. I mean, I think it was criminal.
How did you get through these years of schooling?
I was very introvert, very shy, very profoundly dyslexic, which didn't help. A kind of disadvantage because I hadn't had very much formal education in that early stages. So I was always basically always catching up. Music was my solace, playing it. That was a huge source of comfort. I played lots of, you know, different instruments, and that, you know, maybe that was the bit that felt natural, instinctive from my father's side. So yeah, music was a huge source of comfort. And yeah, I think if people who knew me from back then, they always imagined that's what I would have become, you know, would have ended up doing, because that was definitely where I was happy.
You seem to have come from a background or a family in which culture was an important thing, something you were introduced to as part of your environment quite early.
Yeah, 100%. And I would say not film, though. I mean, let's be clear, the first film I ever got to see, we were growing up in Portugal, there was very little on the telly. I think the telly only played for a couple of hours a night, for example. So that, and in fact, the first English-speaking show was Star Trek. So that's very important to me. To this day, I'm an absolute science fiction fiend. And the first piece of cinema I was ever taken to, I went to see ABBA the movie. It's absolutely, it's seminal work, FYI. Anyone who's never watched this, it's a docudrama. I mean, it's completely bizarre, of ABBA on tour in Australia, but it's sort of hybrid. It's kind of true, but not. And it's this really, anyway, that was the first ever film I saw. So much as to say, film per se, television, no, not part of the fabric of my youth at all, partly because it literally wasn't available and the household was quite strict. Later on, when we came back to the UK, you know, we weren't encouraged to kind of lie around and watch it. You know, that was not the kind of atmosphere of the house. Music, yes, film, no.
So what did you do when you left school?
I got to college, which in retrospect actually still feels like a miracle, because I felt like I was always a bit behind, you know, when it came to academic studies all the way through. I felt like I had to work six times as hard to get the mediocre result. But I was, there was a part of me, I remember sort of there was a moment in my mid-teen years where I just became, this sort of determination switched on in me, this relentless, like, I'm going to do this with my sheer brute force and will, I'm going to do this. And that energy, I felt like once that was switched on, it's never been switched off. And it drove me, you know, managed to finish school and do A-levels. I mean, they were pretty crap grades, but do you know what I mean? I managed to get through and get to uni and kind of get through that. And then there was a moment where, you know, where are we? We're sort of early 90s and it's, I don't know, anyone with a degree is eyeing up all those kind of fabulous jobs in the city, which are various forms of management consultancy, or that was, you know, what was trendy or whatever at that time. And, you know, funnily enough, it didn't look attractive to me at all. And I had this amazing encounter, like a 20-minute meeting with a woman called Mrs. North, who was like the careers officer at uni. I mean, imagine how many kids she saw in and out. I had 20 minutes with her, which changed my life. And she listened to me. She just said, Bede, you know what? You're looking in the wrong direction. Why don't you go and volunteer at the local radio station? Do something else. I have a feeling storytelling story is going to be your thing. And I followed her advice. And, you know, literally that was the turning point. I did a little bit of voluntary work at the local BBC radio station, you know, went out and they were brilliant. They sort of gave me a nagger and said, off you go. And I came out of that and thought, And I looked at media as it was then. And I thought, well, maybe I should be working in news, because that felt like the kind of an obvious thing. And so looked around that for a bit, but I couldn't understand quite how to get into it. And then the first job I got, again, volunteering, was at Oxford Film and Television in London, who are a fantastic small production company. And I started work and began my first week by building their IKEA bookshelves. So I have a very traditional, extremely, in terms of media and television, a very traditional way. I did my, began interning, you know, the most junior roles, and slowly began to inveigle my way into production. And so truthfully, I have never done anything else. Now, it turns out, I look back and actually I have never done anything else other than work in docs since the day I left school, which is totally bizarre to me in some ways. And did that long apprenticeship that our trade often is. you know, if you haven't been to film school or such thing, a very long apprenticeship, beginning internship, junior researcher. And then the piece that was unlocking was that, again, I was a generation that was coming through just as the notion of kind of shooting directors, literally the first concept of that was being tested and trialled within the BBC. And I was one of a gang of the first few, you know, we were young people who were sent out with our own cameras to kind of make our own. And this was revolutionary in the context of the BBC at that moment. And we ended up, a gang of us, they kind of, we were like an experimental pod, and they sent us off to work on this daytime show and film and cut stories for it. And it was the beginning of that revolution. And at the same time that is happening, Hoop Dreams comes out at the cinema. And I go to see it in Soho by myself. And in the cinema, there was about six people in the cinema. And it was that transcendental awakening of like, okay, hold on, I'm getting this very practical experience in British television. But wait, look at this extraordinary crafted long form story, which looks, I can smell and feel it's been made in the same way. This is a man who's going out with his camera and, you know, developing relationships and capturing narrative. So suddenly I was like, okay, wait, there's another option, there's another world, there's another form of storytelling. And even though I'm not necessarily seeing that on the telly the whole time, do you know what I mean? It's accessible, and I can imagine myself doing that. I can imagine.
Let me just go back a little bit there on that story. At 15, you say it was like a switch went on inside you. What do you think caused that?
I was a pretty miserable child. I was crap at school, crap at academics. I felt lonely. I was lonely and sad and a bit crap at school. And they got to a point where I just had enough of it. I can't describe it any more clearly than that, where I just, it was like a red light went on, and it was like, I can't tolerate this anymore. This cannot be what life is, or all it is. You know, this experience and these feelings. And so, yeah, and it was something like that. And I just became determined to kind of throw myself at, you know, at work, at situations with kind of determination and an energy, and compensate, you know, if I wasn't that, you know what I mean? If I wasn't that great, well then what could I make up for just in being kind of relentlessly determined? And the answer was quite a lot, actually. And the many ways you mark it when you're at school at that age, you know, I started getting myself into being a handy part of many of the sports teams. By the way, not because I was great at any of the sports, because I wasn't particularly, but I was a really good organizer. I was a really good galvanizer, and I was really good at kind of G-ing everyone up. So then, do you know what I mean? So I had a role, you know, it came to the plays or the concerts or the whatever. So there was just that kind of, let me just turn the heat up. And yeah, as I say, that's something that's been a permanent on switch. In fact, it borders on problematic, because I'd say here I am at nearing 50 and I don't know how to go at half speed, actually. That kind of relentless, what else? What can I do? How can this, you know, it's exhausting.
Where did you go to university?
I ended up getting to Oxford. Which again is completely improbable. It's so improbable, it's actually laughable. And I think the only reason I got in, I don't know if they even still have it now, but I had, I blagged my way in because I got in on the interview. Because let me tell you, my A-level results were, I think I want to say BDE. I mean, do you know what I mean? So basically I scammed my way in there with that interview just by giving it all this. And then they took me. And then, of course, I profoundly struggled to keep up. I mean, it was, I ended up pushing myself to get there, and then actually didn't have a very good time because it was actually so hard for me. And I felt like I'd had a third of the education of my counterparts, which is actually probably true, just in terms of literally the information that they arrive with and the information that I arrive with. So it was a real struggle. And I remember, you know, there was humiliating encounters when the provost of the college gave me a dressing down for my dyslexia and my spelling. I felt so humiliated. Oh, God, it was agony. Anyway, I wasn't cool. I had to work hard to scrape through. Lots of my contemporaries were literally, I mean, it was extraordinary, the capacity at which they were running. They were just having a much more elegant, smooth time. And actually, I repeated the trick that I did at secondary school, which was work bloody hard. And then my release was in music. By that stage, I was playing in bands, and that was my lifeline. I was like, those two things, music, 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 and just working furiously hard. And that was the balance. And so, I got through it. I got away with it. But my God, they wouldn't have accepted me if they'd known half the truth.
I'm torn between asking you which college you went to or what was the name of your band?
Oh, I can ask me about the band. The college is not that interesting. I mean, this was a group of lads who I'd actually known when I was like 13, 14, who, you know, they were townies, lived, born and brought up in Oxford and gone to local schools there. And then when I come to university there, they're all still there, but a bit older. And it was, the band was called Freak. I kid you not. Oh God, I wish I'd found it. I should have found it. I've got one remaining T-shirt from those days. I should have brought it up. It's fabulous design. Anyway, it was like a indie dance rock, a bit like, do you remember EMF? Mm-hmm. Do you remember? It was like, it was really, I mean, the bottom line is you've got to know, it was just so much fun. It was a kind of dance, yeah, dance rock. I mean, we just had such a good time and we played loads of gigs and recorded a little bit. I mean, when I say recorded, for ourselves, not for, you know, and it was just a source of such joy, such joy. And it was a kind of real gang of misfits, different. I mean, they're all blokes from various sides of the tracks, and none of them were anything to do with the university. Do you know what I mean? They came from all walks of life. And so it was also a chance to escape out of, you know, the bubble that was Oxford and all of that pressure, which for me was really uncomfortable and real pressure, and to muck about with the lads. It was great. It was life-saving, really.
So what did you learn at Oxford? Not literally.
No, good. I think it made me, I don't have very much fear. You know, maybe because you were being challenged all the time. And I acquired a kind of a fearlessness. I mean, I feel like it gave me the benefit that there aren't many situations you could put me in that I wouldn't kind of like work out how to deal. You know, I'm going to deal with it, encounter with this person or this situation. I got tougher. I definitely got tougher. And of course, it goes without saying, learning to, I mean, all decent education, I mean, all decent university experience, in the end, it teaches you to hopefully organize your ideas, process information, right? I mean, if we distill it down to really genuinely the kind of the intellectual skills that you're acquiring. And of course, it did that, and which has stood me instead. But yeah, I'd say that sense of fearlessness, actually, because it was so confronting for me. I had to sort of step up.
Let's fast forward a little bit. So you speak to Mrs. North, you go down to local radio. But what's the moment when you think film might be the thing that you're really interested in?
Well, the kind of the segue from radio to television then didn't seem that dramatic. I mean, it's probably blasphemous for people who are audio fiends. But once I orientated my head around the idea that actually storytelling media was somewhere to explore. And again, I didn't know what or how and what capacity. I had no idea. I had no idea what the roles were. I had no idea who I wanted. I didn't have like a vision. Oh, I'm going to be a director or I'm going to be an editor. I didn't know what any of these things were. So I understood I needed to go in and experience and explore. And the kind of hop and skip, you know, my mum at that stage had a little tiny flat in London. So I went and, you know, moved in back in with her and then just tried to pick up internships. I mean, I wrote 100 letters and the usual thing. And genuinely then I was on a mission just to kind of check this scene out. What was it? What were these jobs even mean? And what was the role that I would feel kind of connected to or synergistic to? And so production for me, and quite quickly it became evident that it would be useful in terms of developing ideas. So I kind of segue into the development teams of different independent production companies. And then quite quickly from there, when you get your projects commissioned, often then you get your break. So that was sort of my path. So idea generation and then getting into production, obviously first as a junior researcher and then AP. And then there's that critical moment where actually the technology's arrived, we can start self-shooting, and suddenly it's like, you're away. You know, I've got ideas, I've got instinct. And then that very, you know, that long journey of training yourself to use cameras and to think about story. And, you know, the first project I started, so literally straight out of watching the Steve James film, I'd been connected to this guy in Harlesden, this amazing young black kid called Julian Golding. And I was like, it was another athlete, but I got the idea. I got the principle that, wait a minute, if you actually follow a young person through a kind of critical period of their life, there's an opportunity to really kind of capture a narrative of transition and change. And I'm up for that. I'm going to ride this. For 4 years, maybe 5 years, I trailed around after this bloke, evenings and weekends and on my holidays. It amounted to nothing. It amounted to nothing. But what was so fantastic is actually I learnt my craft. You know, I was shooting all the time, and lots of things I was coming back with and they were crap or just really tedious. And I was learning patience. I was learning, you know what I mean? Actually, so it's hilarious. So literally I trailed around after this bloke. He's just the best. And I, you know, either I didn't seize the moment or it's just the arc didn't happen. Nothing really that brilliant ever happened. You know what I mean? There was no film, but I was learning and practicing. So I'm sort of operating in a dual life. I'm doing like working on regular productions for telly, standard kind of docs. And then in the evenings, weekends, bits of holiday, moonlighting, making my own stuff. And that's how I spend a very happy 7 years or so, 6, 7 years, those first years, kind of learning the craft, beginning to figure out what I wanted and who I was.
Just unpack for me a little bit about what a shooting director does. So it's just you and one camera. So there's no sound, nothing else. And at that time, you were shooting on tape.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously, there's a million ways of doing this, but my version of it was me and a tiny camera. What were they called? Damn it, I've forgotten the kind of... Anyway, it was one of the first kind of quasi-pro little cameras, a bit fancier than domestic. And yeah, you were shooting on tape, you were going alone, you were sorting your own sound. You know, you might have a decent directional mic on the top of your camera, hopefully. And then, you know, and when you really made the big time, you bought yourself some radio mics, you know. So, but yeah, you were literally going, you know, packing a rucksack and walking out the door.
So how did you then make the step between doing that and a breakthrough?
Well, it's just, there was a twin journey happening. So I was kind of working in mainstream television, getting broadcast credits, feeling increasingly queasy about that world, about the particular kinds of programming that people wanted, that commissioners wanted. They were the way they wanted to kind of treat subjects and communities. It started tugging, and the tug got more and more. And so that's going on. And then meantime, I'm developing my own kind of sidebar projects. And actually, the critical point happens, funnily enough, it comes back to that Julian Golding project, because I hook up with this bloke, Rupert Murray, who's just another kind of great creative who I've come across with the company, and he's like fantastic shooting. And he and I just start mucking about together, and he agrees to do some editing for me on the Julian project and shoot a little sequence on film because he had a film camera. So we just start kind of creatively experimenting together, again, on the side, off book. And there's just a certain point where I go, that's it, I'm ready to jump. I don't want to do these TV commissions anymore. They don't feel right. And I want to make independent work, which I love and I believe in, and I'm going to do it with you. So Rupert and I set up shop together. And again, they're spending another couple of years just in heaven, kind of making predominantly shorts, highly experimental, getting more and more experimental. You know, now I've parked some of the kind of traditional rules that I've been trained in, and we're experimenting with all kinds of format, you know, and just having the best best time. And the commissioning editors are hilarious. We still, I mean, there's still, as far as we know, only one place to go, which is to the broadcast. And they literally, they see us coming and they're like, oh God, what do you two want now? And we're like, wait, we've got this great idea. It's this radical musical documentary. It's going to be set in blah, blah, blah. And we and they're just sitting there just going, this is awful. We don't want your content. But almost to make us go away, because we're so annoying, they're like, okay, well, we'll give you like £10.50 and it's going to go out at 3 a.m. And we'd be like, great, thanks, bye. So we just take whatever was offered and then go away and please ourselves. And, you know, inevitably our stuff would be literally going out at 3 a.m. because it was of absolutely no commercial value. But we were so happy, so happy. And at the end of that period, we stumble into our first feature doc. And that's where the die is cast and the sort of story of Doc Society begins. So it's you know, I feel so proud and pleased that I was trained inside British television with a capital T, that all that means, because I learned so much from that system and from peers within that system. And there was just a point at which I wanted to start making, and I didn't even have a language for it, but actually it was independent documentary film. And I was just, you know, drifting away, trying to find my people, that form, that language, those partners, those funders. And I found that first of all in a, you know, in a creative, an amazing creative partnership with Rupert. And then that would lead directly into the forging of Doc Society.
So what was that first feature documentary?
It's a film called Unknown White Male. It's a cracker. It's a cracker. Saying that, I haven't watched it in about 10 years. I don't know quite if it, maybe longer. I don't know if it stood up. It told the story of a young man who wakes up on a subway in New York and he doesn't know who he is or where he's going. And it's the story of this young man, Douglas Bruce, putting his life back together. And it raises kind of great questions around nature and nurture, because he comes back as quite a different person. He has had a total and absolute memory loss, but he comes back as a different man and a better man and a kinder man. So that's the film. Anyway, it was, we had, again, a riot. Now we were working on a long form palette, and the, you know, the movie does well. It goes to Sundance. We get a big deal, you know, it goes to cinemas and what have you. And that's the moment where you, I describe it as a moment where I kind of felt like I put my head through the cloud line, and suddenly it was being introduced to the world of independent feature documentaries, and understanding that actually there was a whole, rather than feeling like a kind of bit of a freak, oddball in the UK, no, there are lots of us. We're everywhere. And there are British ones, but there are also international ones. And it turns out they're all part of a kind of a beautiful network of festivals and of conversations and of funding, which is separate and other to, you know, the British television system that I understood that was in front of me. This was something completely different. But it was that eureka moment of knowing, these are my people. These are my people. I love their work. I love their craft. I'm in heaven.
So is that the moment when you found what was then BritDoc?
That is the moment. So the pieces of the puzzle come together here, because Jess Search was the commissioning editor at Channel 4 who greenlit the development on Unknown White Male. And, you know, in one of those conversations where she was like, oh God, guys, can you just go away? Here's 50, literally, I think it was 1,500 quid we had to go to New York and shoot the pilot. But we came back with a pilot. And at that point she goes, oh my God, this is a feature. So she saw it. You know what I mean? So anyway, so we had made Unknown with her. And she was working with Maxine running independent film and video. And so the film comes, we had this extraordinary experience all together working on that movie. And it's happening at the moment where Channel 4 want to close independent film and video, because again, it's not seen as commercial and strategic for the channel going forward. And so that's the moment where we come together and we sit around a kitchen table and we go, wait, all is not lost here. What is it if, you know, if there isn't a place for this kind of work, and lots of other artists and storytellers who want to make this kind of work, and the kind of work that was being commissioned and screened on independent film and video, and of which Rupert and I were part of that kind of stable, let's make another place. let's make another home for those people. And there began, you know, so it was the revelation of unknown white male, the kind of that moment where Channel 4 was changing its priorities that kind of encouraged us, forced us to organise, to reorganise and think about setting up a little organism then called BritDoc, which would be the champion of this independent scene. And we looked at all of the kind of, because we suddenly realised there were lots of, there were actually models like that, but in the US, they weren't really in Europe. There was the state funds, you know, the national film funds and these kind of very blue chip bureaucratic institutions that felt very highly impenetrable. But actually in the States, there were variations. There were these little foundations that were there to, you know, institutes that were there to kind of develop and tend to independent creativity. And we were like, wait, we need some of that, but here. So we looked around, talked to lots of people. So BritDoc, as it was first called, was founded, you know, inspired by and on those kind of organizing principles. And Channel 4 sent us on our way with a kind of startup deal, probably quite relieved to close the department quietly and nicely. And we were off. And there we were sitting in East London in a little office with sharing some desks with the team at Shooting People. And we were off.
And you've gone from strength to strength ever since. Tell us a little bit about some of the projects that BritDoc and then Doc Society have produced.
So we're a, for people who don't know us, we're a grant-making, a kind of a grant-making foundation, non-profit foundation. So what we do is we go around, we raise money from donors. So that's, it can be other major foundations, it can be national funds, it can be individual philanthropy, all kinds of money. But we raise money and then we re-grant it to documentary filmmakers around the world. And over the years, that's been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of films that we've re-granted. And in parallel to that kind of central funding and editorial kind of heart, which is the beating heart of the organisation, there's been a series of other initiatives around the outside, you will, which are more about ways of thinking that we could improve the ecosystem, the ecology of our beautiful community. You know, understanding that the traditional system doesn't quite work for us, and, you know, whether it's funding, whether it's distribution, it's never quite the right size fit, never quite the right rules, never quite the right funding sources. And so I suppose we've been conspiring for 15 years to keep thinking of innovative ways to uplift, find new resource, you know, reimagine the rules of the game so they work better for us, for independent storytellers, and not just here in the UK, but globally, because we think that this community are an absolutely vital piece of our culture, which we let dwindle at our peril, actually.
Now you've come full circle, also part of the establishment once more. The BFI have asked Doc Society to run the documentary fund.
Yeah, it's funny how that gave me a little tremor inside my belly hearing that. That totally made me go, whoa. Are we establishment? So we're 15 years old, and yes, I'm proud in that time that we've reached a place where organisations which are as serious and purposeful as the British Film Institute would indeed consider us to be, you know, able and appropriate to run the documentary fund. That's, it feels like a huge honour. It was a huge deal to reach that point. But at the same time, and I'm sure they would concur, it doesn't stop us being just a bit irritating the whole time. I mean, we're constantly niggling and tweaking, and but couldn't we do that better? And isn't there another way to do that? And maybe we could change the rules on that. I like to think that, you know, we're now trusted enough, you know, responsible enough to be given responsibility. But I also know that our job is to keep poking and questioning and not accept the status quo, because the status quo is not good enough. And that I feel very clear about. So, yeah, establishment-ish.
Last time we spoke in a cafe in Soho, we were talking about the prospects for documentaries and for even the British film industry after Brexit. Today, that seems sort of like the least of our troubles. What are the prospects at this moment in time for the industry?
So I'm going to give you a glass half full and a glass half empty response to that. Let's start with the really serious face of this. I mean, I think, yeah, the combination of COVID and then leading us neatly into what will certainly be one of the greatest economic depressions of the last century. I mean, the double whammy of that. I mean, just by the way, Brexit just like now being just totally a little bit of the, you know, the icing on the cake of all of that. This is going to have, and it is already happening, is going to have an absolutely devastating consequences for our industry. And it already is. I think we all know of the levels of hardship that are being experienced by, you know, yes, the freelancers that are not being covered by the job retention scheme or ineligible for support, the independent art spaces, the independent cinemas who are not being given a rent break and are going to lose their premises. I mean, you know, there are, if we just look at the immediate hardship, not even the hardship of 6 months' time or a year's time, it is real and it's desperate. And I guess I have, you know, I've been privy to some of the, you know, the organizing conversations that are having. And I guess I would just say out loud, people know, you know, the whether it be the cultural organizers, and including the state and national ones, they know how serious it is. And everyone is worrying about it, talking about it, planning on trying to come up with different ways to address this. But I just want to acknowledge that, first of all, just the real and evident hardship that we are seeing now and surely will deepen over the next year and a half. And then there's the second piece of that, which is people's desperate need to get going again, to start filming again. And how and when and under what conditions will that be even safe to do so? For on our part, you know, in collaboration with Sundance Institute and Field of Vision, we've just published a set of guidance about for independent documentary filmmakers filming in the time of Corona. It's just it's literally the form of a Google Doc because it's a live document that's being adapted and updated. But, you know, we're trying to offer a framework so that artists and storytellers can think about what's possible and how to do it if indeed they take that judgment that they should and can go back into the field. But we know above and beyond that, there are giant challenges with the industry, like the fact no one can get insurance. Okay, massive problem, massive, massive problem. So hardship, real and vivid, and where, you know, everyone's troubleshooting on that, the logistics of getting going again. And then the third piece of it, of course, which is around distribution and exhibition, which has been absolutely disrupted. And that question about when will we get back to the cinema? When will we be able to collect again to watch films again together is a huge conundrum. What's going to happen to the festival circuit, to the markets that drive our little ecosystem? And, you know, there are some clues already. I mean, we've seen some amazing ways some of the festivals have adapted, even in this spring. I mean, under such short notice, you know, the festival directors the world over have shown such creativity and tenacity. And I think the markets are going well, like the pitching forums seem to still be working and proving an effective place to do business. I'm getting good feedback so far on the whole, the few that have been through already. But I think people that were, you know, there's heartbreak and discombobulation for people that were planning releases this year. Maybe they just sold their film. Maybe they're about to get that massive festival premiere and it's gone. And what do? Do you carry on? Do you pause? Pause for what? Till when? There's a lot there to unpack. So all of that, I mean, in three different ways of, you know, looking at it, incredibly tough decisions for people that everyone is wrestling with. The glass half full piece is, I have never seen or heard such levels of kind of solidarity and mutual aid and collaboration being expressed and demonstrated as a field. And I feel excited by the potential of that, because that can't be an emergency response. There's going to be some new patterns and habits that come from this, you know, new structure, a new level of cohesion and cooperation, which I don't think will be undone by this period. And that really feels important. this is going to be such a massive piece of economic, political, social upheaval. In there is also the possibility of redesigning a more equitable future for our community. We worked with the team at the University of West of England last year to work on their UK feature doc survey. So we had this is pre-corona, we had the first pretty exhaustive set of data which describes the condition and the vulnerability of our independent sector. I mean, really clearly, it's a beautiful piece of work which is going to be published and promoted later this month. Now, that was the position pre-corona. And I think add the impacts of coronavirus and the coming recession. And so what do I think we have, though? We've got the data. We know where we are as a sector and where the vulnerabilities are, which we've never had before. We've got a proper data set. We've got degrees of collaboration and solidarity, which are unparalleled, which I think will give independent filmmakers a seat at the table. We're so often not at the table because we're not big fiction. We're not big high-end television production or big animation, which, do you know what I mean? Many of the production and distribution exhibition frameworks and systems are designed for those bigger pieces of the economic pie. And actually, we feel passionately about making sure that the independent community has a seat at the table, that our particular needs and structures are addressed. And there is the chance to do that, you know, and we are, we're in dialogue, we're in the dialogues, we're in the rooms, we're at the tables. So that's the piece that is making me feel, you know, hopeful and excited. And by the way, the COVID filming guidelines are a perfect example of that. Three completely separate independent film organisations co-collaborate over the writing of a draft set of guidelines, including all of our legal counsels. We then engage another 20 international filming organisations to come on as co-signatories, a piece of work that happens in a matter of days with minimum fuss, drama, no one's needing to own it, claim it. It's just by the field, for the field. And it's that kind of unbelievably practical, useful, productive work that is possible, that is called for in this moment.
And there'll be new stories to tell as well.
There will be. My question to you is there going to be any story which isn't now about, I mean, you know, whatever you were making, there's now a COVID narrative in it, right?
Well, one of the suggestions we've heard on this podcast recently was that actually in writers' meetings, people are thinking when we get back into production, COVID will be over and nobody will want to hear COVID stories.
Yeah, I don't quite buy that. I mean, sure, there's going to be a limit to just how many pandemic movies we're going to want to watch, right? There'll be, but I don't know. I think about other major sort of historical moments just in the last, you know, decade, 15 years. I think about how many films, for example, were made about the war in Afghanistan or the war on terror. Do you know what I mean? I mean, literally so many. And it got to a point where it's like, there just can't be another. And then someone would find just another way to reframe, which was actually genius and revealed something completely new that we didn't understand. I wouldn't underestimate quite how much analysis we need. I think we need a lot of stories because, by the way, it won't be one perspective. It will be thousands of perspectives that we need to understand because people's experiences will have been so different, so dramatically different. But I think, yeah, what are we looking at? Probably a year and a half, 2 years of this pandemic kind of playing out in waves, like a sine wave behind all of our work and practice, and a parallel but longer economic depression and economic and political reorganization, which I think will be the thing that is talked about even more. But I think it's going to be very deep, very deep.
At this moment in time, we'll have listeners, student listeners, young people, anybody listening, who might be entering what's going to be a difficult job market, thinking that they might be interested in a career in film or as an independent documentary maker. What advice would you have for them just now?
I think we desperately need your stories and your perspective and your voice. That's what we need. I think this time reminds us that, I mean, it's a little bit like being in a war, actually, what's happening now. If you think about what's happening, there's the news, my God, 24 hours a day of the news. But actually, how critical can that news be? You know, it's limited, it's contained about what stories it can tell, where it can reach. And I actually think there's an urgent role, particularly for documentary filmmakers, to be capturing this, the whole story and the perspectives of communities that are not being framed and captured. So I think we need it more than ever. I mean, I have a colleague, Maria Ressa, who talked about COVID being an extinction level event for news in the global South. And I just really want to hold that there. You know, this catastrophe, this disaster is being used as an excuse to stifle and control information. Traditional, sources of information. I'm not talking about disinformation. That's a whole other question. Literally just the information we get is being controlled and contained and tempered. And there's also that sense that one can't critique one's own government in a time of national emergency, right? As a kind of underlying thing. We can't be too tough on them because, you know, they're doing a great job under difficult, etc. I think we need to be paying more attention than ever before. This is a huge potential here. Well, not just potential, it's happening already, for a pushing back of freedom of expression, for human rights abuses happening under the cover of kind of the controls that need to be enforced by COVID. And actually, independent storytellers need to have their radars up. They need to be watching, listening, recording, because the imperative of story and of many, many different kinds of communities being represented has never been more important. And I think actually the vulnerability of the whole kind of media ecosystem is high. I would describe it as high, you know, really, really high. And we must fight to make our work seen and shared. So yes, keep making, keep finding your voice, keep seeking out the stories that matter, keep being... You know, the brilliant thing about our community is we're unbelievably entrepreneurial. We've always had to be, because there's been such a paucity of resources. You know, we're always the ones innovating around distribution, always the ones innovating around production and finance and all these things. We have to continue doing that, because this is a time when many of the, you know, even the opportunities that we thought were solid, maybe that beautiful little independent cinema or that creative fund, they disappear. What are we going to put in its place? Who are we going to fight for? Who do we need to uplift and keep? What are the essential pieces of this ecology that we must maintain and sustain? So I think there's a dual challenge, both thinking about your own work and how to keep finding and developing your own voice. Yes, 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 it's actually more imperative in this time than ever. But also thinking a little bit more broadly about, outside of your own work, what can you see and do within your own ecology, within your town, within your city, to help sustain the voices of other independent storytellers? What does that space look like? So I think we should all be thinking about both those charges.
Good luck to us all. BD, thank you so much for joining us in the Lonely Arts Club. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Martin, and huge thanks to your team and pulling this all off remotely. I'm very, very grateful.
This podcast is brought to you by the Institute for Creative Enterprise at Edgehill University, making connections through culture. I'm editor and producer Roz Power, with audio production by Sam August of Onomatopoeia Studios in Liverpool. For further details on the work of the Institute for Creative Enterprise and courses at Edgehill University, visit www.edgehill.ac.uk/ICE.